up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. We have Jim Walter in studio with Matt Byrne on the board. And we're a little late, and you're listening to all this music because we had the buzzer in the building wasn't working properly, so we had to go up and down and get everybody. But here we are. It's a Monday morning. Bears won. The market's up. S&P futures up 8. NASDAQ futures up 67. We're about to make war in the country. Everything's good. You know, as long as we're blasting the market going up, everything's all right, I guess.
Everyone's up.
Yeah, everybody's up. You know,
we're up, too.
Yeah, we're up. Everybody's up. We're, the future's so bright, I got to wear shades.
That's right.
Remember that line? Boy, it was a... Boy, you know, if you want to feel old, Jimmy, old guys like you, what, it was 55 years this weekend, you know, Layla came out and Pink Floyd album. 55 years seems like a long time, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
A little over half a century. Boy, it's a... And everywhere you go, the songs are still getting played. Pretty scary.
Very true.
We have John. We should have Diane pretty soon as well. I hope we don't have to send her a link, but Diane Kelly should be piling in. John, how are you? 55, huh? Well, you were what, 25 when those things came out?
Well, 18.
Yeah. A lot of good stuff written in a short period.
I remember the day Layla came out.
Yeah, I remember it too. And I was only like 8, though. You know, just saying. Well, maybe not.
First time I heard it, got, you know, guy down the hall had the album, blasted, you know, full tilt. So that was a memorable day.
Yeah, we had some guys that got the albums quick. Matter of fact, we had a record store when I was it sophomore year. Dr. Blade and I had a record store on campus. We were what, student record sales or something. You buy an album for, I think it was $3 or $4 or something.
Wow.
I used to drive to Chicago and get them. If you went and got them, they were a lot cheaper than if you had them delivered. So then I'd come back with about, you know, a couple hundred
Capitalism
albums.
Capitalism at a young age.
And I remember we had a, what was the one with, was it Cat Stevens? It was a hot album we bought.
The Tillerman?
Yeah, T for the Tillerman. I think we bought 25 of them. Every single one of them had a scratch in the exact same spot. So we had to take them all back. It was only like at Palatine. It was a little bit of a kick from South Bend in my my luxurious 65 Olds Dynamic 88 that burned more oil than it did gas, and it burned a lot of gas. Those were the days, John. You didn't worry about that kind of stuff. Then we had a cell phone. If you pulled over, they actually had something like a payphone, that kind of thing.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Plus, remember Cat Stevens performed in Notre Dame. I mean,
yeah.
Some of the great music acts of our time, we got to see, you know, and when I think back on that, that was pretty amazing, really.
Well, nobody, I won't say there wasn't money involved, because there sure as hell was, but for some reason, the biggest bands were not too big to play in a university setting, and they would play 3-4 nights a week sometimes. So it wasn't like if somebody came to town, it was, you know, Millennium Park, or not even Millennium Park, it'd be, you know, Soldier Field or something like that. We saw pretty much everybody that came through.
Oh yeah, huge. You know, the biggest names, really.
The only one was kind of weird was we couldn't afford, we, the Irish, they couldn't afford Pink, it wasn't Pink Floyd, it was, who's the guy with the flute? Jethro Tull.
Jethro Tull.
Yeah, couldn't afford him on a weekend, so he played on a Monday night.
Right.
Which was pretty cool. So we, of course, since we were over at the Convo anyway, no point in walking back to the dorm at 10 o'clock, we sped up to, it was the only time I was ever in the place, that little saloon right over the border in Michigan. That was the name of the place, on the right side. Not Kubiak's, right after Kubiak.
Shuba's, huh?
No, it was,
there were like three of them.
Yeah, we piled into that place to get some burgers, and who's in there but the band? except for Ian Anderson must have had a limo home. But all the other schlumps are in there grabbing beers and burgers before the long ride home to Chicago. So I was talking to the drummer and one of the sound guys. It was pretty cool. wasn't a heavy conversation or anything, but it was kind of neat. I said, "Hey, where's your boss?" "Ah, he's going on a limousine." "Okay." But he was pretty good.
The best music event I saw that time, and it was by a long shot too. It was sophomore year, Duke Ellington and his orchestra came.
Really, I did not see. Now you'd have been at that. I didn't.
They performed at Steppen Center. You know, remember that horrible place with the geodesic dome. You know, had the worst acoustics of any enclosed space.
It was a concrete floor and a metal roof. How bad can it get?
And there was this huge blizzard that day. So the attendance was pretty sparse, but it didn't matter to Duke. I mean, that was just that whole event was just a revelation. I'd never seen such playing, and it just warmth with the audience. And he had a couple vocalists, and I was just like blown away, completely blown away. And I'm so glad I got to see it. I think he died 2 years later. So.
Well, Kevin says it was Jay's Lounge, still going strong.
Jay's Lounge, that's good.
Yeah, wow. You know, there was actually some, even though the Irish and Michigan have already, so through the years, have managed to have a lot of controversy around football. One of the priests at Notre Dame was a huge jazz fan. And he, in the Michigan band, which is usually one of the best marching bands in the country, in some of the musicians there are really into jazz. So they would come play at Notre Dame once in a while, and I always went to see them. They were terrific. I mean, if you love jazz, they were really good. They used to play at just the student center for nothing. You'd walk in and sit in a big sofa and listen to these guys. They were pretty good. And but no, I always saw Chicago was there, Three Dog Night. I'm trying to think of who wasn't there. Never saw the Moody Blues.
No. I saw Joni Mitchell. I saw... Beach Boys, a couple times.
Yeah, a couple times.
And Livingston Taylor, Poco. Yeah. I'm just thinking, I could make a long list.
Yeah.
Of the great acts and cheap ticket prices and bands that were really at the top of their form when we saw them. So.
Well, John, what do you make of seeing a lot of stuff about the? We've talked on the show, and of course, for whatever reason, we seem to talk deeper on this stuff. Maybe because Wayne and Andrew were so involved in it. When I say involved in it, they've covered it from God knows when. It was pretty interesting on Thursday when those guys were talking about it's really 80% espionage and 20% perversion, and it's absolutely not being covered like that. Which is, Wayne sent me something the other day about how he ranks this, the idea that we had the U.S. of A., essentially allowed a sleazebag like Epstein to essentially have an ongoing thing where he compromised politicians and people seemingly with everybody else's secret police, whatever you want to call them, involved on our property. We're not talking about the island. We're talking about here in Manhattan and in Florida and in New Mexico, really, to some extent. The idea that we allowed that to happen or didn't know it was happening is stunning. It has nothing. I mean, you can add the little girls to that, but he claims that's the biggest screw up here. He goes, it's like the Philby thing. It's that big. When you had, it's Epstein with essentially a conduit to Russia telling, and then other people tell them everything all about what our politicians and businessmen were doing here and compromising them. I mean, nobody's thinking about that, are they?
No, but you know, it goes beyond that too, Tom, because a lot of the politicians who were, you know, material for, you know, blackmail or whatever, were already compromised. When you think about people like Dennis Hastert, who I think the only reason he was in politics at all was because he was blackmailable. It wasn't like they got to him afterwards.
Wouldn't you like to know, you know, and I know you guys, the Democrats could always be worse, wouldn't you like to know who the hell put him in office? And who had the strings to him and knew all about it?
Well, somebody who knew all about it.
Yeah.
I think you have to admit, I think. And he's not the only one. There's Barney Frank, tons of people that, you know, when I think back on it, these people made a meal out of, you know, their time in Congress or whatever by living, you know, what we would consider pretty much on the edge probably all their lives, whether it was organized crime in Frank's case or pedophilia or God knows what. But it passed under the radar, and so far under the radar that nobody even talks about it anymore.
Well, you know, years ago when Wayne first came on, he said, if you paid attention, you knew about it. And I said, how the hell do you know about it? He said, well, everybody gets one or two. They're not really boondoggles, but everybody in Congress, well, I don't know what you want to call them, but everybody in Congress gets a couple of trips a year, you know, to go see stuff. Like if you've never been to Africa or Egypt or someplace, you get to go in a delegation of some kind, and you pick one or two a year. He said every year Hastert went to Thailand with some guy from California. He goes every year. He goes, so why would somebody go to Thailand? I mean, I guess once for they get Thai food, but the second or third time it's for other stuff, right?
Yeah.
I know. He goes, everybody had a pretty, he said, if you paid attention, you had a pretty good idea. Now, it didn't give you the idea of who put him in power and, you know, what string they pulled right at the time they wanted to pull it. And, you know, that's what I, you know, it's a mini theme of the show, John, but when you get like, you know, somebody making a big contribution to, you know, who's ever run for whatever, I mean, what do you expect to get for that? Or if you're a insurance company that supports a judge, say, well, do you do it just for the off chance that there's going to be some big case in front of that judge someday? I mean, what do you expect to get? I guess is the big time question.
It doesn't even have to be a big case, Tom. If you get enough small cases and you know which way they're going to go, you're set. Yeah.
Well, so, yeah, cool. But I mean, can you pull a string on every single case, or can you pull it once? I mean, Jan, we're from the South Side. You know, the alderman gets Uncle Joe a job. You're probably going to work a precinct for him, but you're not going to give him $1 million. I mean, what's the price list for this stuff, and what do you get? Because you know there is one. I mean, if you and I, Bill Murphy just went to my buddy. His niece, I guess, held a fundraiser for Molly McElroy or whatever she's running for senator in Michigan, and she's a Dahmer, 40-ish years old, degree in engineering. He says she's really bright and really, you know, very impressive. But now, if you go and you give the person $1,000, what do you get? I guess you get to meet him. I don't know. The person who has 20 people there, it turns around and gives them a check for $20,000. What do they get? You know, do they get? I don't think you get a cell phone number, but do you get the AIDS number? I mean, what do you get? And what are you doing it just because you're a good citizen, or are you thinking you want a job someday? You got a bill in Congress. I'd love to see, because you know there's an implied list on all this stuff. At least you think you would. I just wonder what the person who put Denny Hastert, how big are they? How high up the chain are they? How often was that string used, if at all? Right? I don't know. That's why I'm asking the question.
Well, it's pretty hard to determine because, you know, and you don't even have to be very far up the chain. You can just be off the, you know, the organizational chart, at least the public one, but everybody knows of your existence and nobody wants to tangle with you. And because they know it's not worth it, or there's dirt on you too. So there's, it's this vast protection ring where it doesn't even mean you're at the top of the pyramid. You could be somewhere way down. But you got your fingers in so many points of the pyramid that it's, you know, you're pretty safe. And it doesn't even have to be, you know, where you're doing nefarious things all the time in a position like speaking.
Well, you may only have to do it once or never.
Yeah, right, or never. But the idea is that you're controlled, you know, and whatever you're doing, you're not doing it as a free agent or somebody who's got, you know, an ethical, you know, backing like you would expect somebody to have at that position, but or hope they would have, I should say. But it just has to be something where you know you are not your own person, and you've got to clear everything you do at some point with some other group or some other person, or you're going to be cut loose, as Hastert was eventually, you know, completely cut loose, you know, pretty much destroyed. Except, you know, they destroyed him so well that nobody even thinks about him or puts, you know, two and two together to figure out why was he there in the first place.
Well, you, so, you wonder what does you wonder what did they go after him for afterward? Was he about to spill?
Well, they might have had, you know, suspicion that he was wavering or that he was forgetting who put him there, or he was, you know, whatever.
Just a loose end, like you'd see on TV.
Yeah,
just a loose end.
Not being cautious enough and forgetting who, you know, paid his meal ticket. So, and of course, when that was, you know, the right time for whatever was controlling him, there was no going back. And, you know, it seemed like it was synchronized in a way that, you know, there was nothing more to be said about it. He was, you know, obviously, you know, involved in something horrible. How he was able to hide it for so long.
But didn't they wait till he had cancer or something?
Yeah, I think, well, that came out in, I think when he was, you know, about to testify or there's some health issue that arose. And that kind of, you know, was a way of.
But the issue was from before he even went in, right? Or no, right. He was paying somebody off.
It was a structured payment thing. Yeah. And then it was a civil lawsuit by the guy. I mean, to me, if this is a, you know, contract against public policy, how does this guy get go in and try to sue for the back payments? And is there some court that's listening to this guy? So the whole thing looked to me like it was some ridiculous, you know, charade, you know, in the judicial arena, that, you know, there's something else going on here than what we've been told.
Well, so, I mean, as we've, I don't know if you've listened in on Thursday, but when Wayne's more into this than Andrew, because Andrew goes to more, like, Andrew's still representing people in court and stuff. But, you know, Wayne goes back on this stuff, and it the more you listen to him, whatever your political leanings are, It's the idea of how many decades it goes back with Maxwell's father and stuff. I mean, everybody jumps on the perversion piece. Well, you know, if you get people messing around with underage girls, yeah, it's pretty screwed up in a lot of ways. But it seems like, what did I say Thursday? I thought I said it's 20% that, it's 80% other stuff. I mean, how far back, how many, you know, what the secret police was, what was Maxwell's. He was with the Mossad. He was with the British people. He started out with the guys in where? The Yugoslavia or someplace?
Yeah.
I mean, every one of these guys are sort of tied into this guy. They thought he had a fortune. Turns out he had no dough. I mean, but these people were getting compromised all along the way. I mean, and what damage was done to us and other people? I mean, and it's still happening. I mean, yeah. I mean, you like the idea of a bunch of old white guys and a bunch of Arabs and other people coalescing somewhere to mess around with 14-year-old girls. I mean, for God's sake. But, I mean, it seems like it's way more than that, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, if you've already, you know, decided as, you know, some intelligence outfit, which lives in the shadows, you know, and that's how it succeeds, you've got to have people who also are familiar with living in the shadows. So they've got, you know, secrets they want to keep secret. They've got, you know, peccadillos or failings or, you know, habits that are, you know, just, you know, hated by the general public. So they have to conduct them, you know, behind the scenes or off stage. So you've already, the intelligence communities are already, you know, kind of, it's understood you're good material for us if you've been living your whole life as a lie. Well, this is just what we need in the intelligence business. So this is why people are targeted, I think, and selected.
Well, I'll ask Jimmy, and Wayne pretty much asked this question. He goes, which is worse, that the CIA and all the people, he worked for NSA, we've got how many intelligence agencies? He goes, which is worse, that we knew what was going on, we, our intelligence agencies, on our property, and I'm not talking about the island down there, that was like one of four places the guy had, right? We either knew what was going on and let it go on, or we didn't know, which is worse.
Well, think down to the latest disclosure about, you know, the rep in Congress, who's the delegate from the Virgin Islands, who was, you know, grilling Michael Cohen in Congress, the Congressional Committee, while she's texting Jeffrey Epstein, and he's throwing questions to her, and she's asking the questions, and he's responding, good job. I mean, do you think the fact she's from the Virgin Islands has anything to do with why she's talking to Jeffrey Epstein? It has everything to do with it.
I would say, Matt, do we have Diane?
We do indeed, yeah.
Hi, guys.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Good morning.
Happy Military Monday.
Yeah. Hey, do you realize what you started on this show? We ended up having like five or six people talking about veterans and psychological stuff and everything, and we dug all the way through everything. And it was through people when they got out. You know, what happens when you muster out? Do they even give you a train ticket? Do they care where you go? And one of the guys who said is, where's your last address? He goes, what difference does it make? They don't live there anymore. it's absolutely, it got more into, and you started out with, well, just as a background, everybody knows Diane. She's been a few times. I think they do. She's the major domo of Fisher House here in Illinois. Fisher House is, for lack of a better term, it's around McDonald for veterans people where the family can stay there when the military people are in one of the various veterans homes, and there's one in Hines, and there's one just opened up at Great Lakes, and they're countrywide. And actually, Mike Murphy said there's a couple of them in Europe, Dan.
Yes, there's one in Germany and one in the United Kingdom.
Yep, that's what he was saying. And then, but it kind of, and Diane made the mention that there's a lot of psychological issues that are affecting people that maybe don't get treated as much as they should, and those guys are in the hospitals, and then we kind of morphed out from there to Kenny Polcari just out of the blue the next day after you were on, Diane, talking about that. So, you know, I was just involved in this big fundraiser for the Headstrong Initiative, and which does a lot of psychological work with vets that aren't in the hospitals and people that are just outside. And we had a lady on who was helped by them and is not working for them. She was, get a load of this, Diane, she was, she learned what's the Afghani language, Parsi or something?
Farsi?
Afghani language is different. It's a subset of Pashto.
Yeah, okay, that's what it was.
There's two different.
Well, whatever it was, she had to go to the Language Institute in Monterey, and she learned all this stuff. And during battles over there, she would be on air with the Afghani guys intercepting the stuff, translating live to our people, and she had, you know, she's kind of a perfectionist personality, but terrific lady. She said, every time I made like even a second of a mistake, I figured I cost a life. So when she got out, she had problems, and she said the veterans group was really slow. Like, yeah, you get an appointment in 6 months, and she ended up with this headstrong initiative, and they helped her out so much that she now is working for them, sort of like you're working for Fisher House. And then we went from there to Hal Snarr talking about when he was in the Persian Gulf on his nuclear cruiser, how the water was 93 degrees. They were there for 44 days. They only had one freshwater maker instead of two, so nobody could take a shower. And he basically never got out of the downstairs of the thing where it was 140 degrees. And he said there were days that if the water wasn't 93 degrees, he'd have swum home or tried to. So, I mean, we started going from what you started us out with to this whole mess of how do we take care of these guys? What happens when they leave the post? Do they even find out if anybody's in any kind of shape? Do they care whether they live? Do they have enough money to get an apartment? You opened up Pandora's box, shall we say, Diane. Just saying.
Well, it's still a major issue.
Yep.
And there's still some, there are veterans groups that are trying to help with this. I don't know that many of them. I know that like Hines is probably not as equipped. I think Lovell is working a little more on this because of the active duty members that they have up there, which is kind of interesting because, you know, you get these young kids that go into the Navy and they're, you know, maybe 3 months into it or even less than that, they're like, oh my gosh, what did I do? I can't handle this. And then they start freaking out. So, you know, that's where they need some help to help these recruits. And I really don't know if they are letting them, you know, with a discharge or if they're trying to help them out. I do know that a few of them have been at Lovell.
Lovell's the one up at Great Lakes, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
So, you know, some medical issues, a few days in the home so they can go, the family's in the home, so, and then, the member is going back and forth to the hospital for some treatments of whatever sort. So a few of that. But, yeah, it's really, it's a very sad aspect because, you know, I would venture to say that every single military personnel that has served, no matter what you see on the outside, the inside, there is struggle. And some of them deal with it better than others. And I see a lot of that. Like, I was just there on Sunday at Hines, and because I'm part of Chaplain Services, and one of the gentlemen that was there left, and now he's back, and you know, he's got some medical issues, and he was very upset because they're telling him that he needs long-term care, and so he's asking why he can't stay at the extended care area at Hines, and the requirement, so, you know, needing long-term care means what? What does that really entail? Is it mental long-term care? Is it physical long-term care? So there's just a lot of areas that I think that the, you know, the VA needs to really look at and try to help out more, because I do believe now a lot of the Iraqi and Afghanistan military coming back, they have seen a lot of horrible things, and the mental strain on them is just really severe. And a lot of those military from Afghanistan and Iraq have lost limbs. So
you're more with the, not more with, but unfortunately you're with the physical leading to the mental, back to the physical. And it's last Wednesday, if you get a, I know you're busy as all get out, but if you get a chance, listen to last Wednesday's show. Dr. Johnson was on.
Okay.
And it turns out he, my roommate in school, his nickname was Blade, so Dr. Blade. He enlisted after he got his degree. So,
and
he was in psychology at Notre Dame, and he ended up. They sent him to, you know, essentially graduate. He got his graduate at Penn State and his doctorate at Dartmouth or someplace, but he was because the army was essentially footing the bill, he did all his whatever you want to call it, residency and so forth, I think it was one of the forts down in Texas or someplace, where they had all kinds of issues. It might have been the one where the burn place is, one of them. Anyway, but he was really up
center,
on it.
Yeah, burn center is in Texas.
Yeah, and he was saying that every war has its different stuff.
Yep.
And yep. He went through some stuff that you would never, you and I, well, you might have, but I would have. He said there were, he goes, now the families are so disparate when people come back, you can't count on the family really to be any help in a lot of cases, because the family could be gone. Like Wayne said, when they asked him where his previous address was, and he goes, I know where my address was, but nobody lives there anymore. What am I going to do, knock on the door? He said, but he said the, Jimmy, you were, what, did he say something about it? There were 27 support organizations, you know, the Elks, the Kiwanis, all those, and there are like four left.
Yes.
Something along those lines. And he said, just the whole chain of who you funnel into is not like World War II, where everybody came back sort of at the same time. But then it kind of got into when people muster out, they don't have any idea whether the people are healthy, which is what you're talking about, Diane. I mean, when Hal said when they were in the Persian Gulf, they came all the way back to Seattle on this boat that's going 12 knots. He said that took forever. But he said, at least you could take a shower and the water was cooler. You get to Seattle, I said, okay, you're done. The guy I was having dinner with yesterday said, yeah, they flew me from Germany to Fort Dix or someplace and said, okay, you're out. He goes, I don't even think they gave me a bus ticket. No unemployment, no idea of what your next job's going to be, no idea of your... He, fortunately, his family still lived in the same place. He could crash back there for a while until he got himself together. But it seems like the whole thing from day one is a mess.
Well, I mean, what's so interesting is that if you look at our country and you'd start with the Revolutionary War and the Civil War and Korean War and Vietnam War and then all these wars. And so this PTSD goes back all the way to the Revolutionary War, and they didn't understand what it was. And then they finally, during World War One, they finally called it shell shock, and then it just kept leading up into PTSD, but they've never really figured out how to deal with it. And it's kind of like, I would have thought that the military would have, you know, with their doctors, and they would have had this figured out before now. And but now I will say that it has come to the forefront, and it's top of mind of everybody, because this PTSD has related to the suicide of so many veterans. I mean, one out of every five veterans are committing suicide. So that PTSD is very, very real. And it's, you know, unless they start giving them some really treatment, it is going to continue. So.
Well, how much of it is John, pile in there wherever you want. I mean, how much of it is, as Dr. Blade says, the mental health of the country, with all the people arguing with each other about politics and with the COVID situation and the lack of support groups, has never been worse, in just about every level. But he said it runs such a huge range. He goes, some of it is if somebody hears a car backfire, they hit the ground, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
He said there's also people that are in the wilds of Afghanistan, and in fact, one of the listeners wrote in when she was, I think you were on, she wrote in and said she knew somebody that was someplace, and they went to use the bathroom or something, and there was one of the soldiers from the other place grabbed a gun, so he shot the guy out, and he's like, what am I doing? I'm halfway world around, and I just killed some guy. I don't even know who the hell the guy is. And what am I doing over here? I mean, he said there's a lot of moral issues with killing people. There's a lot of, he goes, there's a list. He went through about five of them until we kind of shut him up. But I mean, it's so different. You can't just say battle fatigue or PTSD. Everybody has, some people have been in war. Some people lob people's legs off at mash tents. Some people, I mean, it's all over the place.
Oh, totally. I mean, it encompasses a lot of different areas. And, you know, you hit it on the head, you know, guilt, the survival guilt, their buddies are gone and they survived. Why? You know, so there's so many areas of this, and that is, you know, psychology, sociology, doctoring, you know, that is something that, you know, you and I will never be able to understand, but I can kind of understand some of it. you know, the loneliness, the living in that world of your own, and just, I mean, I think all of us can really relate to things that have happened in their lives, and then, you know, at nighttime when you close your eyes and you can, you know, you can see some things or whatever. So think about this 1,000 times, you know, exaggerated, or just, I mean, I really understand some of this, what they're going through. And the sad part about it is that I just, you know, boy, when they talk about freedom is not free, these guys, people that, men and women both, that have, you know, sacrificed to do whatever they need to do for our country, is just so amazing that they're willing to do that. And I don't know if, you know, going forward, when these younger generations see what the, you know, what these military, some of them have gone through, and the trauma and the stress that is put on them, I don't know. Are they going to go into the military after seeing some of this?
Well, I don't know why you sort of, you do or you don't, but it's, the idea that we've had 4 people on after you, again, you started all this. We had 4 people on it, said basically when you get out, you're just out. There's no thought of what you're going to do next. I mean, Mike was saying that some people, you know, if you're in supply or something, you probably can get a job, you know, where people are ordering stuff. I mean, but if you're just plain infantry for 20 years, you're not just plain infantry, you know, a lot. He goes, what do? You go into security, or you become a mercenary for somebody else? There's no thought of what's the next job going to be. I mean, he might fortunately work for intelligence in kind of an area where when he came out, he got hired by a group that contracts to do intelligence. So he actually ended up, I don't think it was day one, but so there was, you know, there was some gap in there, but he ended up essentially with another job. So he said he landed pretty good. I mean, that maybe not ideal, but, you know, but Mike's a real smart guy, and he managed to kind of in the same area. He's about to pile out an inventory, and, you know, infantry, I don't even know, could you get unemployment right away? The guy I asked yesterday, he said he never even thought of that. I mean, is there any sort of a, you know, if I'm not talking about somebody who was in there 2 or 3 years, maybe I guess you go back to the GI Bill. This lady was saying she did the GI Bill, and she was in Colombia, and she was 25. And it seems like there are some places that are hotbeds of colleges where they have the GI Bill. Kevin says there's a boatload of people at Ivy Tech that are ex-military that are doing GI Bill there. So there's, I guess, Indiana. Russell says that's a pretty big hotbed too.
Yes, I mean, and so I just met with a lady who came out of the Navy, and they're giving her 6 months to adjust to regular life. She's getting paid. She's, you know, going to be a school teacher. She's going to do that, but they're giving her 6 months of adjustment time.
Who's they? So, the Navy?
Yep, the government. You know, coming out of the Navy, and so she was overseas. So, you know, I think they're trying now to make sure that the adjustment time, you're just not sort of, you know, said like, okay, you're out, gone, goodbye. So now they're trying to make, you know, adjustments for going back into society.
Well, how long was she in? She wasn't just 3 years, was she?
4, I think.
Okay, so they are doing a little something, because, I mean, you can't, I mean, how do you even get... If you don't have a job, you can't even get an apartment.
Right. So they are trying to make support available for coming back and you know, going into society, going back into society without just, you know, the shock of it or the trauma of it. So at least you've got some money, and you, like you said, you can get a place to live, and you can kind of figure out what you want to do with still getting some income.
That's the most positive thing I've heard all week about this.
Yeah, it's good. You're right.
I ask one more question, and then John can pile in. This Headstrong thing, they are, I mean, obviously, it's for veterans, but they really don't want, they're not affiliated with any of the the veterans' homes. There's no connection there with the money. Because their idea is if somebody needs some help, and that's kind of how it started, this lady couldn't get into the veterans, even though she didn't start the thing. But they said, if you go online and you say you need some help, they're back at you in 48 hours. And they have people in every, I think they're in pretty much every state, but these are outside psychologists that they pay going rate. It's top dollar, where they actually will get you in, and it's kind of a 9-month program, but it's totally designed for people that are not going to the veterans home or just have issues outside of that, or maybe they're going there for physical. The connection, and then you wonder how much responsibility of that is supposed to be the government's, and there's no answer here, Dan. I'm just want your opinion. It's like in the city of Chicago, or the federal government. We're going to cut back on food stamps, but by the way, the Chicago Food Depository comes up with 200,000 meals a day. Well, okay, that's fine. I mean, whose job? It's nice that they do that, but does that mean the other people don't have to do anything? You know, that's what I'm saying. I mean, there's kind of a conflict here of some kind, isn't there? Or am I just making one up?
No, I mean, listen, I'm a firm believer that we are all put on this earth to help each other, and that's what we're supposed to do. And thank God for this organization, because they can take care of someone so much quicker than any government organization can do. And that's why, you know, our organization, their organization, all these veterans organizations that are truly helping these people are so important, because that's what we need to do. We all need to come together to help our veterans and help anyone who is in need. And that's, you know, that's my format of my life. I, you know, whoever needs help, we are all to be here to help support anyone that needs help. And, you know, it's kind of like with Fisher House, we buy all the supplies and the food and pay the Comcast bills and all the, you know, electrical bills and all this kind of stuff. So in order for these houses to get money from the VA, it could take them 6 months.
Yeah.
So, and that's why our position is so important, because we are the everyday support system for the homes. I mean, I just got a call last week and the house is filled, and she said, Diane, I've got 3 families that need hotel rooms. So I had to find hotel rooms, and I do have a relationship with some hotel rooms that's in Westchester and close to Oak Brook. So I call them and we get the hotel room set up, but we pay for that. So, you know, no family is turned away on whatever needs that they have, and we take care of that. And but I, you know, government is government no matter what happens. It's the bureaucracy of government, and I know that they're looking at trying to change things and streamline it. It's probably not going to be in my day, so because there's just too much.
You wonder if they're really trying. I mean, the thing you don't want to get into, and I've seen it happen with Notre Dame and Notre Dame Club of Chicago, which is another story, but what you don't want to have happen is for guys like Kenny and you to bust your fanny and raise $4 million and some buffoon in Washington saying, well, there's $4 million we don't have to spend. I mean, you don't want to get to that stage.
Right.
And I think, you know, that's just kind of the way people operate somewhere. John, do you have any questions? Diane? You're hanging.
Diane, you know, when you said, and I completely agree about, you know, the people who don't have any obvious, you know, injuries or anything, but they're damaged too. It doesn't matter where they've been or what war they've been in. They carry that you know, guilt with them. It made me think of the high profile cases that kind of, you know, soured the public on Vietnam, you know, Cali and the My Lai massacre in 71, and the Abu Ghraib abuses and the, you know, prisons with waterboarding and torture and everything else, so that an average service person who was merely following orders to be there at all and to do what he or she was told to do in the public's eye now carries the collective guilt for, you know, the high profile cases that were politicized and changed, you know, many people's thinking about why we were in these enterprises in the first place. So it doesn't have to mean that you had any kind of physical injury of any kind, but the mere fact you served and that this is the place you were at, and maybe you did or didn't see the things that people think you did, but you carry that guilt, you know, for the rest of your life. And I think that's got to be a huge, you know, burden for anybody to carry, especially when you see how the winds of public opinion drift back and forth about what was this a good idea? Did we meet our objectives? Should we not do this again? But it's the individual service people who carry the brunt of that, and they're the ones who pay the ultimate price. So it really looks like the political class gets kind of, you know, off the hook here, and the service people are kind of scapegoated in ways that they never expected to be, or you know, thought they ever could be, to have all this stuff pinned on them. And that's got to be a real contributing factor to the loneliness and the suicide that you mentioned, such huge numbers. That's just staggering, 1 in 5.
Yep.
I just can't get my head around that.
I know. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you could look at someone and they just look perfectly fine, but you have no idea what they're dealing with mentally. I have a really good example within my own family. My husband's nephew is a youngest sergeant major at Fort Campbell, and he was in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he is the 101st Division. And he shared a little bit, just in the, you know, he was just like, oh, he said it was bad. And I've noticed he's changed. He's not the same as he was before, and he doesn't talk a lot about, but you can just see his mindset is he's very focused on, you know, he's gonna finish out. He's got 2 more years and he just wants out. He just wants out, but he'll have 30 years in, and he's got 2 daughters and a wife, and but he's not that sweet, kind person anymore. He's very, he's just not, he doesn't have a lot of patience. And I noticed that he's not the same. And I don't know how to just describe it other than he is not the same person that he was when he went in. So.
Does he ever, the World War II group, you couldn't get him to talk about it. I mean, maybe amongst themselves they did, but nobody else could.
No, exactly. And that's when you find these stories from World War II is so incredible because, to your point, Tom, nobody spoke about it. They didn't want to talk about it. And particularly some of those soldiers that had to go to these camps with the Holocaust survivors. I mean, the stuff that they saw was just... They would never talk about it.
So. Well, I told this story a couple times. My mother died, and the guy who I shared a spot was a spot that was enough for 2 people if you liked each other, but in the OEX pit. Anyway, a guy named Ronnie, terrific guy, we're friends to this day, and I went to his dad's wake, and I see all these medals, and I go, Ron, was your dad a destroyer captain in the South Pacific or something? He goes, yeah, I just found that out, too.
Oh, geez.
Okay, then. I mean, it really was, their attitude was the people who were heroes didn't come back, and we're here. And we did what we had to do, and that's it. I mean, I'm sure at the VFW hall, you get feelings that when they came back, there was like a lot of drinking involved, and finally everybody got married and, you know, had families and didn't talk about it anymore. It's kind of an odd way of going about it. And the Vietnam people were abused when they got back, because they were losers or something, or I mean, that was a whole different, right. Of ball. But there was a lot of people from World War II were able to pile right into college and the GI Bill, and to a certain extent, there was probably a better support group for that group than virtually anybody else, unless you were black, okay? Because then you were here and you had the GI Bill, but guess what? The schools wouldn't take you. You could get a mortgage, but they wouldn't give you one. So I guess that didn't help those guys out too much. And the women that nobody talks about. The women didn't get anything, even though they were...
Gosh, the women. I was at the Women's Military Museum last year in D.C. Oh, my goodness. That was just such a moving... I couldn't believe it. I mean, from the Civil War all the way through to Iraq, Afghanistan, these women, I mean, there were some amazing women of what they've done. And just to your point, nobody ever talks about it. I mean, it's like they never even get their due date, but wow.
Well, the story Lou tells, this is kind of weird, but I'll be real quick with it. My uncle got killed in Germany, all right, and going over some bridges. And for some reason, the family thought he got killed in the Battle of Bulge, but he didn't, which is kind of weird because they sort of had the wrong view of it until I actually went through and found out he died on a day when they were taking a bridge from France to Germany or something. But anyway, it was kind of misinformation about the whole thing. But his Purple Heart was kind of in the wind. So some lady spotted it, saw our name, found my brother's address or phone number, and basically called him, a lady from Beverly that does all this research. So we ended up getting his Purple Heart from a group that actually, there's a charitable group that tries to attach medals to people that are in the wind back to the people, whether they're in a pawn shop or wherever the hell they are. And so we ended up getting the Purple Heart. And she sends us all the articles and the obituaries. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, the dude died in 45, early 45, and he gets buried in 48. And they're talking about, you know, the funeral, and a lot of people at the funeral, because everybody, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm thinking, wait, what happened for 3 years? And Lou goes, oh, yeah, when there was some kind of a deal, if you're taking a bridge and 50 people die, you get a mass grave, you toss everybody in there, and then you yank one of the dog tags. And then years later, there's groups of women, and they might have a couple guys who have to dig the hole up, they're matching the dog tags to the decaying bodies in the pit.
Yep.
And I'm going, whoa. How do you get that job? And then they find the family, and they say, we can either bury him over here, and there's a lot of cemeteries in Europe, evidently, or we can ship the body back. But by the way, once the body gets to you, the funeral and everything's on you. I guess they bought the headstone, the concrete headstone you see on Mount Olivet. Those are all the same, John. I think the Army paid for those, right?
Yeah, they're Army issues.
So he comes back and he's buried 3 years later. I'm thinking, those women never got any GI Bill. They never. Did they even get veterans home? Did they even get veterans stuff?
No, they will get veterans pay, but any kind of dollar amount that is due to them. But there's no veterans home that I know of. I do see a few women over at Heinz, but very few. But. Hey, I know you guys have to leave, but I wanted to say a couple of things when you're talking about medals. So we're having an Army-Navy game. It's a fundraiser for Fisher House. It's December the 13th at the Roselle American Legion. And the Medal of Honor recipient, Alan Lynch, will be there to sign his books. We're giving out some of his books that he has written. And the other is General Mukayama, who was in Vietnam. He's got a book out. So he will be there signing his books too. So I wanted to just let guys, your
that's
viewers...
That's the week after Thanksgiving, right? That's after all rest of college football is done?
December 13th.
Okay, yes, I know it's the last game, right?
Yes. Army-Navy game, December 13th, noon at the Roselle American Legion.
No, that's Roselle's west, right?
Yes. I'll send you a flyer, Tom.
Yeah, that kind of sounds like fun. The one thing you dragged us to, you invited us to, where the guy had the musician. Does he still play over the Veterans Home? Who was that? He said he used to come go by the Veterans Home and plays over there once in a while. The guy we went to, what western suburb did we go? We had dinner and then we went over and.
He hasn't been there for a while.
He was really good.
What was his name? I can't remember.
I don't know. He's up there. I mean, he was those guys were all mid-70s, weren't they? They were all playing.
Yes.
He was one of these guys, John. Like he was in a cover band. Well, before they were called cover bands.
USO.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was from the western suburbs. And he played with all these different groups, and he was telling us that one night he gets a call, and it was dead of winter, and there's a flu going around. They called him. They said, Roy Orbison's playing at the Park West. Would you come by and be the guitarist? The other guy's sick. And he goes, I'm there. He goes, it was so much fun to go play with Roy Orbison. I guess these guys go play with just about anybody if you're good enough. I mean,
yeah, they will. You know, it's like kind of a USO cover band. So yeah, but I haven't talked to him in a while or heard.
Yeah, wonder if he's feeling good, because he was not a kid.
No, and he has had some heart issues, I know. So it's like,
well, this Roselle thing sounds like fun.
Yeah, it should be fun. It should be good. And then, you know, we're doing a holiday match challenge. We have a really good organization that donated $25,000 to us for our holiday match challenge for the month. So any money that you send will be doubled. So that's a good thing.
Hey, Di, before you dash, take a minute. How the Fisher House up in Great Lakes is different, because there's active duty people as well. Do you want to just go in there just for a minute?
Yes, it's the first of the Department of Defense and the VA merging together to create one home to help active duty and veterans with any kind of health care needs that they have. So the Great Lake Naval Base, because it's the largest recruiting base in the country, we have a lot of recruits coming through. So whatever needs happen, our home is there for them.
So every other veteran's home is just, I won't say older guys, but basically guys that are not in the Army anymore. They just are in need of medical treatment. Now, this one here, there's people that may actually go back on a ship, right? I mean, they're in and out.
Correct. Yes, exactly. So it's very different, because, to your point, most of the other Fisher houses throughout the country are, you know, located at hospitals where veterans are getting treatment. And, you know, there might be, like, in the burn unit. So if a soldier is somewhere overseas or whatever, or locally, and is active duty and has, you know, gotten burns or injuries or whatever, and they are at one of the medical facilities, and their families are 50 miles away, they can stay at the Fisher House too.
Okay. Hey, you know, I lied. One more question. You know, we've forgotten the whole week you just brought up to mind. The people who show up, the family, to stay at the Fisher House, how are they doing psychologically?
Well, you know, it's hard for them. But I will tell you that one of the things that the greatest gift is that home. Because you have to think about this. Think about staying at like a 5-star hotel, free of charge. Everything's there for you. You know, at Lovell, we bought robes with our logos on it. There's a huge kitchen. If you can't sleep at night, you've got your own private room. But if you can't sleep at night, you can go into the kitchen, have some tea. There's always snacks there. You can sit in a beautiful room, watch television, listen to some music, or you can just stay in your room. But the families are more of like support systems for each other. They really help each other, because they can talk about, you know, whatever their loved ones are going through, and they kind of help each other. And, you know, these are sanctuaries for these families. And some of these families are there for 2 weeks at a time. I mean, we've had one family there for 18 months because of the treatment. And then sometimes, you know, they know that the loved one is not going to make it, so they're staying there while they're waiting for, you know, the ultimate to happen, but inevitable. I mean, so these are just really the testimonies that we get from the families is what keeps us going. It's just the best, because we know that we're doing something good for these families.
Well, I think
the people that are in the hospital, they're getting treatment. They can relax, because now they know that their families are close by and they don't have to worry about them, how they're going to get there, or the traveling back and forth. So it's a win-win for everyone all around.
Well, that's cool. So we're going to send out all the places, the address and all that stuff. We'll send that out to everybody. And Dan, as usual, I have a hunch I'm going to see you Thanksgiving weekend. You don't know that yet, but I think Audrey might be having a party that Saturday.
Yeah, you're right. We always look for it.
She better have a lot of chow now since we just blasted it out on the air. who knows? We might even see John Flanagan show up. You never know. I mean, that's
Alrighty.
He'll show up with his fork and his toothbrush. You never know that guy. But Diane, you take care of yourself. I hope the weather stays nice. We don't want to be you heading out to Maywood at 5 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday through a snowstorm. At least not. It's not good either.
All right,
take care.
Thanks again, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Jan, give me a summation.
Well, this is, you know, it's the loose ends of wartime. I'm just trying to, like, make a catalog in my brain of all the things that get dropped at the end of any kind of, you know, military effort. And, you know, The government does a pretty poor job of cleanup afterwards. It doesn't really take account of the families that are, you know, broken up, or the bodies and minds that are destroyed. It's looking to the next, you know, budget allocation, and, you know, hoping that somebody doesn't, you know, pin anything on them before they get the next appropriation. So this to me brings it into very sharp focus that there's a complete lack of interest in the follow-up for whatever kind of military incursion is being put on the draft boards, drafting boards. And then the draft boards, of course, you know, may someday get involved in it too. But Diane points to the real, you know, the loose ends that are not, you know, they're not negligible. They're overwhelming in a way. And the destruction that, you know, passes from generation to generation because of our neglect, you know, the families that are trying to hold things together, and when they have something like Fisher House that lets them at least be with their loved ones because they're at a military hospital where they don't live near, and they've got their own lives to live too.
Well, that's, you know, a lot of the people here, the cancer treatment and stuff she talked about last time she was on, it's like the cancer center for the whole Midwest. There's people from Southern Illinois that come up here every month for 2 days while the person's getting the chemo, and back to Southern Illinois. I mean, it's a regional thing.
And even that, you know, that's a function too of the specialization for the kinds of injuries and, you know, long-term effects that people deal with, where there isn't, you know, it's not the sort of thing where you can have these facilities everywhere you need them. You have them where you can put them, and everybody else has to get there. And if you're not, you know, near one of those things, you know, you're in isolation from your family if you're in the hospital, and the families don't get to see their loved ones in these hospitals because the way they've been designed is to treat injuries that, you know, require a focus and a specialization that maybe nobody really thought too far ahead how this would really work out. So we've made war so sophisticated and the injuries so unimaginable that we've made it harder for families to hold together when there is somebody who needs treatment. That's another downside of the kind of wars we fight these days.
Well, John, how much of, I mean, as you know, my gift to the show, and also the boring part of it, is for me it's always kind of the numbers. I mean, if you're pricing out a railroad car and I go, what the hell is that take out to do with everything? And you price it all out, and I get my number, and I got the labor hours, and I've got the supplies. All of a sudden, I get my number together, and somebody goes, "Hey, idiot, we forgot to give you the number for the air conditioners," which is a big part of a car. And you go, "Well, that's going to change some stuff." Duh, where was the number for the air conditioners? Well, that's, you know, that's really a problem with your organization. Or you're cheating, or you're lying, or you're doing something. You're either very inefficient, or you're just plain lying. And I used to think, when I was young and stupid, that this stuff was all just things that were kind of just good-hearted mistakes. And now I don't think that at all, John. It's part of me being, I'm getting more conspiratorial or more cynical or what. Because when we went into the U.S. of A., went in with the weapons of mass destruction fiasco in Iraq. And basically, not only did we screw that up, but we pretty much destabilized the region that we're having problems with to this day, right? Right. I think you make that statement. You would agree with me on that. But I read this thing at the time, and I don't know what I did with it. a guy estimated using the government's projection where he found them of how many people, and it's not so much how many people die, I mean that's really bad, but you're done with them, right? It's the people that are wounded you have to take care of, and those are the people at cost to a huge extent. Then they were talking about regime change and having a base there for how many years. And anyway, the guy totaled it up. He was, I think, Jen and Jimmy, $1.5 trillion. And this is when? Was this 1990-something? I forget even when that was. Or was that Bush was in office, so it had to be 2000, right?
Yeah, the Iraq and Afghanistan, yeah.
I don't remember. It's a part in history. Yeah. But so the idea, I mean, and the neocons, you know, the Rumsfelds and Cheneys of the world, Cheney just died, they were all for this. They wanted all this, you know, regime change, they wanted all this crap, but they also wanted their taxes down at the same time. So then they lowered taxes like a month or two before or about the same time we did this. So
yeah.
I just wonder, I think enough people knew how much it was going to cost, and I think they just lied to us. And if they would have said to the same, you know, excuse me, John, on this, Republican neocons, and there were, I'm sure there were some Democrats in there too. There's a lot of Democrats that like to go blasting people. If they were to say, by the way, if we're going to go invade this place, blow them up, not really worry about the consequences. Hopefully, some of our guys will get the oil, which is really the reason for it, wasn't it? Some of our guys are going to get the oil, but by the way, it's going to cost $1.5 trillion, so we need a 20% surcharge in everybody's tax for the next 3 years. I have a feeling the decision would have been a lot different, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, think back to September 10th, 2001, Tom, you know, the day before 9/11.
Yeah.
The Pentagon just sort of slid it into the news cycle that there was $1 billion missing from the Pentagon's budget that they couldn't account for. I'd like to know where that $1 billion went and, you know, how it had been covered up. And it's exquisite timing that the next day we had 9/11. So the two events, I don't think, are...
Maybe they were buying puts in United Airlines like everybody else.
Well, yeah, yeah. So, but none of these costs would have been factored into any kind of, you know, budget anyway.
No.
Could you imagine if somebody had to go in and say, by the way, the contract, the way we did it in the past, here's what we're appropriating in the billions for military hospitals that are going to have to be built in huge numbers to accommodate...
Well, that's what I'm saying. To say that, you mentioned earlier, these are the unintended. I don't think that there are people who know what these numbers are going to be or close to it, and they're totally ignored or shut up, because if people knew going in, we wouldn't go in. Or maybe we wouldn't go in. And that's a whole different... It's the same as me getting a bill of material from Pullman, and the guy left out 3 items because he wants the job. Okay, so we get it, we lose money at it, which is the same thing as what we're doing here, right? We're losing money at it.
Well, nobody wants to hear about that in the, you know, the run up to any war where it's got public opinion, you know, being goosed and, you know, fears being raised, and, you know, everybody thinks this is some kind of patriotic mission unlike any we've ever fought before. The stakes are higher than they've ever been before. So we really aren't interested in computing, you know, the cost of no, you know, military operation ever really has had any interest in computing, and that's the aftermath. So it's bad for business if you want a military that, you know, is going to leap in when it's appropriate, you know, or whatever money is to be made has to be made now, or there's no point going in at all. But these are the things that people are much more concerned about than the long-term consequences of taking innocent lives and turning them into machines and then throwing them away when they no longer serve their purpose. I mean, this is the ultimate disposable.
Well, the people that are always for war are people that never fought.
Right. The scene in It's a Wonderful Life where it shows what's happening in Bedford Falls during the war, and Lionel Barrymore and Potter, the banker, is sitting there. He's of course managing the draft board. Yeah. 1A, 1A. 1A.
Well, you know, that was...
This guy can't even walk.
You know? Yeah, it's... Well, you know, I mean, there was I really pushed this book, and I shouldn't, I guess, but read Freedom from Fear from William Kennedy, and I've never read all about the difference between the people who wanted, you know, there was a big tug in World War II because we not only we were fighting, but we also had we were supplying the rest of the world with weapons. So guess what? In order to do that, you need people to build them, right? So the army wanted this, you know, was it 5 million man army? They never got, above what, 3.5, Dad, or 3.7, because the people here are saying, hey, if you take the other million people, you're not going to have any tanks to drive because we need people here to work on this stuff. And my uncle was a tool and die maker. He was locked in here. He couldn't go anywhere. I think if he didn't show up for work, they were going to come after him. You know, I had two uncles like that. Now, on the other side of the family, they were all in the army. So it depended on whether if you were, you know, one of those skilled labor sets. And I had one uncle who went to Hawaii, but he was, I think he was in ship repair. I think he worked for a contractor, which meant he got no GI Bill, none of that stuff. No, and he would never have gotten any veteran stuff, which kind of sucks, too, because you're over there, they landed a bomb on everybody. You know, they landed on you, too, right? Yep. So, I mean, it's... There's a million issues when you do stuff like this, and I think we don't like to tell people what they are because guess what, we probably wouldn't go if we did.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a kind of crazy stuff. What do you make of what's going on? We got 4 minutes before we go to break here, and have Audrey on. What do you make of what's going on down in Brazil? What are we trying to do with this? I mean, is this some kind of a diversion? Or what, I know the guy down there didn't leave office, and he's not a good guy, but. I don't know, we're not going to start bombing the country and say, we'll show you guys, are we?
Well, you know, I don't want another war, that's for sure. But you know, the whole thing with, you know, Lula and Bolsonaro is you know, the same kind of template that you can see happening, you know, throughout the EU, you know, renegade governments, you know, trying to, you know, quash the opposition. So whether it's, you know, France. I mean,
we're not doing that here, are we?
No. I mean, pick your country, really. But, you know, the Bolsonaro case is particularly egregious because...
All right, tell everybody what that is.
He's the, you know, the popular candidate who has just been, you know, lawfared into a hospital bed, you know, literally.
This is the guy in Venezuela.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, Brazil.
Brazil.
Maduro Brazil. Is Venezuela.
But, you know, this is, you know, Lula is the socialist, you know, maniac, you know, got his, you know, diehard supporters and on some sort of sacred mission, you know, to get rid of Bolsonaro. You know, so this is the way politics has kind of devolved, descended, you know, in the last 20 years or so, where it shows how high the stakes must be when you can, you know, completely twist, you know, all elements of you know, the media and the political strategists and the judicial system and everything else to, you know, completely neutralize, intimidate, or worse, to your political opponents. And, you know, I can't think of too many models for that, you know, before. Well, I'm sure there are lots of them. I'm just not able to summon them at the moment. But it's now happening in what we would consider developed or developing countries. Unlike in, you know, two-bit dictatorships, but this is the sort of thing where, you know, to become an outsider in that kind of culture, you are not just an outsider; you are an enemy of your own country, and this is, you know, we can see it happening here.
Well, we had the one lady being called a traitor. How can you be a traitor to a person, or do you got to be a traitor to a government?
Well. It works both ways, depending on who's the one who feels intimidated.
I think two things, John. And we got to go break because we got Audrey coming in. What is you and I are agreeing way too much today. You know, I think
that's a good side, Tom.
I think the average person, and I'll put myself in that group. You don't have a mind big enough to realize how much money there's involved to the people in government, how much you can give it out to people. I mean, you'll have, I won't say some dummy, but some uninformed, and I might say the same thing. You'd say, gee, why does it cost $40 million for a Senate campaign? This is outrageous. But think for a second. Just think for a second. And take 10 minutes and think of the last bills that were passed and put on a piece of paper. There has to be 50 to 100 companies here, and just here, not just overseas, that'd be happy to pay the whole $40 million. Because the one contract, one wink and a nod in an antitrust case, one anything like that, is worth billions, not 40 million. It's not even close. I mean, I think people have a, it's like me, I freely say, I don't know what $1 trillion means. I mean, I can't even conceive of that, for God's sake. And yet, and I'm in the money business. I mean, the regular people have no clue of how much money these places pass out. And Trump has got a lot of it in the open. I'm not saying he's certainly not the first. Basically, you bring the guy a bag of money and you get a government deal, or you get the right to sell stuff to another country that nobody has. I mean, I don't think the average person, me included, has any idea how much that's worth to people. I mean, the idea of the, what you just mentioned, the peaceful transition from power, and the idea of the, what do they call it, the loyal opposition, nobody does that, because the money, we and a few countries in Europe are the only people in the history of humanity that ever did that, except for maybe ancient Greece and Rome for a while. I mean, it is such a sacred thing. If we screw that up here, we're not that far away from another Brazil, right? But they've always been like that, right, down there.
Well, and they've got some of the, you know, the same, you know, racial tensions, cultural tensions, you know, indigenous population tensions.
But it's all the money, Janet. Who gets
right.
what?
Right.
Anyway, you're hanging around for a ride, I hope. SP Futures sure. down 7, NASDAQ Futures down 22. We have a quick break because we didn't do a sports. Matt's got to tell us all about the Bears winning. And we'll be back with Audrey.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI ProDirect can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI ProDirect. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
Hello, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. Matt, you got me going nuts now. I know that song real well. Who is it?
That's The Animals. Don't Bring Me
that's
Down.
Right, that's right. That's right. Wow.
Eric Burden.
Wow, that's got to be 55 years ago, too.
Yeah, it's pretty Jeez. Pretty old. Yeah, Eric
older
Burden.
Than that.
Older than that. Wow, The Animals. Well, he quit The Animals because his hearing was going right. Then he joined another band. Didn't he join Mountain or someplace?
He was with War for a little
War.
While.
War,
yeah.
Okay. Was he? Who was with? Wasn't he with Mountain, too, for a little bit? I don't know.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Yeah.
SP Futures down 9, NASDAQ Futures down 35. We were up all morning and all last night. Now we've turned down here, and we're trying to find out exactly why, if there is a why. Dow Futures down 45 over in Europe. DAX down 164.7%. That's a pretty good move. FTSE down 24.3%. That's only a little bit. CAC around down 40.5% over in Asia. We've got the Nikkei down 52. That's almost flat for those guys. Hang Seng down 188.7. I think they were up on Friday. Shanghai's down 18.5%. So we kind of, just as a way of review, on Friday, S&P was down 3, but we had probably, we were down an amazing amount in the morning, and then we came flying back to unchanged. And I think a lot of it had to do with people front-running the tariff announcement that we were going to lower the tariffs on the agricultural thing that I got to miss them about 3 o'clock, but I think other people maybe got it before me. But it's so hard to say. Oil up 26 cents, 60.35, right around the 60 number. So oil has like not been an issue at all here for a while. Gold down 17 bucks, but still over 4,000, 4,076. Silver unchanged at 50. We've got foreign exchange, which has been volatile. At the euro at 115.94, so the dollar is still pretty strong. It was over 117 about a month ago. And we've got the British pound at 131.7. It was 135. So again, these are pretty good sized moves. Crypto down, Bitcoin down 76, 94,193, a long way from that 126 top of, say, a month ago. Although Ethereum is actually up 41 bucks. It's the one's been causing all the trouble. We're back to 31.40. Matt, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Bulls lose double overtime. Saw that.
Yeah, we got some good news.
One.
Yeah, that's the big news of the day. We'll get into that in just a second. It is currently 7:36 on November 17th, 2025. Weather in Chicago, 32 at O'Hare and 31 at Midway. High of around 48 with increasing clouds today. Down in Phoenix, Arizona, cloudy with 57 degrees and a high of 72. Now to the big meat on the table, sports. NBA, Bulls lost a close game last night against New Orleans Jazz. That was 150 to 147. Bulls back on tonight against the Nuggets. That game starts at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. And now over to the NFL, of course. Bears won yesterday. That was against Vikings, despite the Vikings' two touchdowns at the tail end of the game. Final score was 19 to 17. Meanwhile, Packers beat the Giants 27-20, and Lions lost to Eagles 16-9. In the current NFC North standings, get this, Bears now lead the way. 7 wins to 3 losses this season, my document has fallen apart a bit, but they are tied for second place in the total of the NFC, which is pretty impressive.
Well, they haven't played any good teams yet. We'll see how they do in the
we'll
second
half. We'll see how they do when they get some good teams. Yeah.
Wait a minute. Vikings were supposed to be good.
Well, yeah, they were supposed to be. I have a question for all of you. Do we have Audrey?
We do, yeah.
All right, I have a question for all of you mavens. What is a scratch kitchen?
What?
A scratch kitchen. You heard me right.
A scratch kitchen?
Yep.
I don't cook enough to know that.
Bud, you're in real estate. You're supposed to know all this stuff. Ford is opening their new massive headquarters, a 2.1 million square foot headquarters. For God's sake, that's, you can make airplanes in that thing. And Dearborn, Michigan is ceremoniously opening Sunday, although construction is expected to continue to 2027, another 2 years. Automaker is trying to make coming to the office more enticing with scratch kitchens, more outdoor space, and places to collaborate. And I'm sitting there
waiting. Oh, it probably means instead of getting your lunch out of a vending machine, they might have a real cafeteria, maybe?
I don't know.
Maybe Matt can check while we're talking. I'm sure we can Google it.
Or does that mean that you'd actually have, like, microwaves and stoves other than just the refrigerator and the vending machine?
Does that mean we have a scratch kitchen here?
Yes, it probably does. It might be ahead of the trend.
God,
you're a trendsetter.
Well, yeah, that's well, I
don't
know.
Who knew?
Yeah, who knew that I would be a trendsetter? God. Well, we just told everybody about your party on the air. You know, a lot of people over.
What party?
See how she is? One after Thanksgiving, the Saturday.
Oh, the no turkey, no relatives party.
Yeah. Well, we can't have Jan. He's almost like a relative.
It's like no turkey and no relatives you don't want to see again until next Thanksgiving. So you can bring whoever you want except that. So,
okay. So Diane was on. She was terrific as usual. I don't know if we caught any of that, but
No, I did not.
But she's the best.
Wonderful. Well, she's like the most amazing person, one of the kindest and smartest people. She's so good to everybody. If somebody's going to go walk right through heaven's door, it's going to be her.
Not only that, she usually brings good wine. As a sommelier, one would expect no
less. Absolutely.
Take 2 seconds. Tell everybody about the trip you went through Sonoma and what's the other Valley was with Diane Caff leading the way.
Oh, okay. It was, oh gosh, that was quite a while ago. But we usually try my best friends and I to go someplace wonderful every 10 years. That's because we're all so busy. 10 years could be the best we could figure out. But thank God, with to Diane's connections at the time, we had stayed all through the Napa and Sonoma valleys at a different bed and breakfast or private housing owned by 6 major wineries in the region, including Moet Chandon at that time. And it was incredible. We stayed on a private farmhouse in the middle of a vineyard, just like in a movie. That we had entirely to ourselves. We stayed in the owner's housing at every different winery and estate, and had our own private chefs and people cook for us. And one night we each had our own treehouse apartment in the top of a tree. And one night we stayed upon top of a mountain on a single track footpath to get to, and then the staff brought us breakfast in the morning. I could get really used to living like that.
What do you no guys, John? What do you think of that?
Well,
us chicks had a lot
part
of time.
Appeal,
plus,
I think.
This was wonderful.
We get a load of this. This is so female. They decided they got to have a convertible, right? But the convertibles aren't very big, so they had strict luggage regulations so they could get the luggage in the back of the convertible.
It was a Mustang.
That's what I'm saying. It's not very big for 4 people.
Well, to the point that there were 2 about it. It was Diane, so Diane's small enough. She only counts as half a person.
I'll tell her you said that.
I tell her all the time. She's such a...
So you think Jan and I, what if Jan and I were with? We wouldn't have been in that car.
We guys would have been tied to the bumper.
Anyway, what's going on in the real estate world? I know you've been still pretty busy, even though it's pushing Thanksgiving.
You know what? It's very busy in that little downward... burp in interest rates has gotten a lot of people out, and plus there is a big pent-up demand for housing. There just is, especially out through my area.
What is that, because rents are so high?
Well, there's just not enough housing, and people aren't moving out again, as we talk about it every week. Is we've got to do something with the people that have 3% mortgages and have no interest in moving because there's absolutely no point to it. So I heard Trump had floated, when somebody in his administration had floated an interesting idea, John, I don't know if you heard this, of giving people who have these low mortgages the ability to take that percentage for that balance with them and just get the new mortgage for whatever it is on top of that. So if you sell your house for $500, you have a $300,000 mortgage, you could take your $300 at 3% and use that on the next house.
Well, it's an interesting idea.
It's a portable mortgage.
Yeah, portable mortgage.
We do have them in the sense of VAs and FHAs because those are assumable. Now, Europe has them, but they are very different in the sense that their mortgages only go 5 or 10 years, and then afterwards you have to renegotiate. So you might not be able to hold that rate.
That makes sense.
Well, this is different than when I was remodeling some houses back in the 80s. People, when the mortgage rates were really high, you actually had the assumable mortgages were that the other person could assume your mortgage. It wasn't like you could take it with. This is something different, right, Art?
Yeah, this is like you literally could just take your whatever your balance is, so then you would be more incentivized to move. Like, I think more, a lot of people would. I think a whole generation of seniors whose homes are either paid or let's say have a half a balance or so, and they're like, well, why am I going to pay 6 when I have 3 and incur all the additional costs of moving and financing if I don't have to? So at this time, it's a wish, it's not a need. So a lot of people, no matter what age group, are just going to say, there's no incentive for me to move. So it's clogged up the pipeline, basically.
What is that?
That's what's happened. And that's what's forced prices up, too. So if they would this whole, if let's say even 5% interest rates came back tomorrow, you would see the whole situation change. Everything would change because, of course, scarcity raises prices, and that's been part of the problem too.
Well, what the, I mean, maybe it's more of a Jimmy question or Jan. I mean, the mortgage area is, there used to, way back in the day, there used to be, if you had a big enough house, it wasn't even really a mortgage. It was more of a personal loan. You could always take that with, right, if it's a personal loan. But how many people have those? One in a million?
Very few.
Because that way the mortgage...
It depends what it's secured by. If it's like home equity, a loan or something, no, because then you would have to close that out if you sold your house.
He is talking about a personal loan. So it's not done by the... The loan itself is not tied to the property.
If it's personal, no, but how many people have that kind of...
Well, but if I had 5 million shares IBM stock and I took out a loan, nobody cares if I use it for a house or whatever I use it for, right? I can take it wherever I want it.
True. On a margin loan like that, yes, because the stock is the asset that... Is the collateral. If you're not using the house as collateral, the big problem with the portable ones is it would cause a problem with the mortgage-backed securities, because now... How am I going to package this?
Yeah, that's true.
Because if you're moving it from one house to the next, and again, this is a little different because in the United States we have it. Europe doesn't have mortgage-backed securities. We're the ones that came up with it, not them. So it's a little bit of a problem, and then he did float the 50-year. That one's a little, again, you know, of an issue too, because then how do you price it? Because a 30-year is priced higher than a 15, so a 50 would have to be priced higher than a 30.
I don't think it would cut your payment down that much, would it?
No, they did the numbers at 6.25 on a $500,000 house. The difference in payment would be about $325 a month.
Well, for some people, that's their utility bills.
That it is. But you also have to look at, Audrey, that you're not paying anything down on principal for almost the first 25 years of that loan.
But it's amazing how many people, and I'm not saying it's right, I'm not saying we should, but it's amazing how many people would probably do it the same way now if you're getting an 8 or 10 year car payment. So the car is probably no good. And not even saleable to pay off your loan within the last 2 or 3 years of the payment. So the car is going to be junked and you're still going to owe on the car?
Well, the idea with cars, and people do this with houses all the time, and my advice always with cars is don't ever get a loan longer than the warranty period. I mean, if you can, because for God's sake, you don't want to be... But people live in houses all the time, right? It could be 2 months later, you need a new air conditioner, you got to pay it.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, a lot of people either, you know, you've either got to, you know, it's not like you can call the landlord to fix it. And I think that's the shock for a lot of people is, you know, a house is almost like a living thing. It always needs something. And I will tell you the minimum, most homeowners will, everything is at least $1,000. I don't care what it is. It's $1,000, it's $5,000.
Yeah.
Everything, and this is always, that's just now. It's like everything is more than you think. And unless you're really handy or lucky and have really handy relatives, you're in the pyring.
What is the, when I was driving home from your place yesterday, I heard a term, and now of course I forget it when I'm telling everybody about it. There's a new, what do they call the new, it's not a double, you know, a second job or a third job where they call it, Jan, you probably know this, I bet Nancy does. There's a term for it, begins with a G. Where,
a gig? It's a gig?
No, but it's people who do like two or three different things just to make ends meet. They might, you know, deliver pizzas on a Saturday and do something. So it's not really a second job, but you might sell some stuff on eBay, or, you know, the wife might go one day a week.
It's a gig economy.
But that's not the word. It's about eight letters in
it's
it.
It's all
something.
I got.
Yeah, it's all, and I forget, but it was it's something you can't even really quantify. It's these little cash gigs where you're maybe, you know, painting somebody's gutters on a weekend, or
a
you're
side
doing,
hustle maybe.
Yeah, well, it's like if you have five of them together, where you have a whole bunch of things going. You know, you might be refereeing. Well, I'm just saying that a lot of people are starting, because Nancy always mentions that, that people are up to, it's not two, you know, both people working, two salaries per household, so you're almost up to like 2.5.
But you know what, a lot more people do it now, but I can remember growing up, my dad either taking any overtime he could get or doing, you know, side jobs for the neighbor, or my mom had a part-time job when I got older. So it's not like a new thing. The different thing is, I think that more people were doing that to help save. Like, they didn't, I didn't grow up, we didn't have very much money. My dad worked at an old steel mill in the middle of the city. So anything that was brought in from anywhere was always used, but they were also conscious of always trying to save something. So a lot of the second time and overtime money got put in the bank for whatever, you know, a new appliance, whatever. Because, you know, at that time, too, most people paid their houses off. They got married, they came home from the war, got their house if they were lucky, and tried to pay it off like in 5 or 10 years, because nobody wanted debt. At that time, debt was like you were a major loser if you had debt. And there were no credit cards then.
Well, right? you always had a couple of department store cards. You had Sears.
Well,
no, cards.
Well, yeah. You know, that did not happen for a long time either. There was layaway.
Yeah.
Before there were credit cards, so people weren't. It wasn't as easy for people to get into debt and also need that second and third.
Well, you had no 401ks. There was no IRAs.
But you had pension plans and companies actually funded them.
Yeah,
and you had paid insurance.
Well, your dad was lucky that he ended up getting his in the steel industry, because a lot of people there got stiffed.
Yeah, my dad was, and then the union, my dad was anti-union for a long time, but when he did get in, it did save his pension and save his job. That was a very long time ago.
John, you remember that?
I think that's the difference.
John, you remember that outfit on, I don't know if it's the same company, but I'm sure they've been bought and sold 100 times. The guys that made the water heaters, Rheem and Kedzie?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I think they did something. Audrey and I know a couple people that work there. And they did something weird there where they had a pension and they... What was the story about? They moved the plant to...
You know what? You have to ask Nancy more. She knows more about that than I do. But they eventually shafted the workers that didn't get their pension. So.
Because they gave everybody an opportunity to move to, like, it was either Mexico or New Mexico or something.
Yeah, you had to move. Otherwise... too bad for you.
Yeah, they stiffed you on a pension. I don't know. And how many people, a lot of the steel companies, and I don't want to go through the whole story, but it was so scary, because those things were so overfunded in the 70s, because interest rates were 12%. Those people stole all that money. Did anybody ever go to jail for any of that stuff? I almost feel like I'm talking about Carl.
Tribune, too.
Yeah. Well, that day, what's his name? The guy who just croaked.
Sam Zell.
That was a
Keogh used plan. Their pension money to buy out the to buy the Tribune and the Cubs and all of that. Yes, he did what Kravis, Cronenberg, and Roberts perfected, which is the leverage buyout.
Yep.
What was I don't even remember. What was a Keogh plan, John? Remember what that was? Keogh plan was like an IRA, but you had to include all your employees. It was like a. We actually had a few of those here at PTI. There were a lot of medical groups, not a lot. We had probably 5 or 6 medical groups that we managed their money. And all of a sudden, one day, all the lawyers saw, now we're not doing this, even though we were doing a really good job for everybody. At least I think we were. It was a long time ago. And, you got to do the 401k thing. And we're like, wait a minute, we're doing way better than you really want everybody in the place managing their own money when, we don't want the liability. I mean, the Keogh plans, but I think the Tribune was a Keogh plan. That Zell popped into somehow.
Weren't they? They were self-employed, weren't they? Was that the deal with those? Or
no? But if you had, I mean, if it was Audrey Real Estate, and she had 15 people working for her, you just couldn't open up a Keogh plan for yourself. You had to include the other 15. It was like forcing you to almost have a pension plan for everybody else.
That's a little early for a run.
Yeah, the guys downstairs. Well, they do all the expressway stuff, too. Right now, I notice you've been, I don't pay any attention, I pay attention, but I don't want to get involved in Audrey's stuff because I just mess it up. But it seems like you've got some people really struggling to get entry-level houses.
Well, there's just, and bear in mind how what the price of entry level is now. It's, you know, right around out in the southwest side of the city, Oakland and stuff. I mean, you're talking like $350, you know, for an entry level house.
We're talking a bungalow, or no, you call them raised ranches now.
Yeah, you know, like $300 to $350. You know, let's say $375.
Are these fixed up or need work at that number?
Well, it depends. Again, but I would say something that will be okay but still need work is probably about $330.
So livable but need some help with $330.
But,
yeah, and
but not state of the art, let's say.
And if it's fixed up.
Do people, you know, who are first time buyers, you know, out in the market, do they have any options in new construction? I mean, this is the wrong time of the year for new construction, but even if it weren't, are there any developments you know of that are pitched towards first-time home buyers?
You know, not that around this my area that I've seen. The problem, you know, as you guys all know, the land has gotten so expensive and the building cost and the density has driven the affordable builders, you're pretty far out. You're talking now, Manhattan used to be the edge of the universe, basically, but, you know, that's getting built up. But Shorewood used to have affordable. Shorewood is now also very pricey. So are you finding something in the twos? Maybe condos or townhomes, maybe, but even a lot of the townhomes around here, you'll see a lot of these, I call them what they'll be expensive tenements down the road, is those three-story, like, row houses that are jammed on plots of lands throughout Tinley, Orland.
Those things are butt ugly. They look almost like a
four-plus-one. There's no yards. The garages are underneath. They're three stories, and they're something that if you have kids or you're old, you're going to move out of. So I think it's always a way for builders to get on lots, make a big density of profit, move on. But even those are in the mid threes and up. So that's a lot of money. And then you add your monthly fees on top of things like that. So unless you're willing to go off the beaten path, but as far as new construction, I would say very difficult. You're seeing a lot more building going on through like the Piatone, Moni area, down the I-57 corridor. But it's tough. It's tough. Otherwise, you're going to end up in they're much smaller. You're getting a lot.
Just in the last couple of weeks, there's been an explosion of for sale signs just within walking distance of me. So you're right about there being so much pent up demand that's kind of apparent now. People have been waiting, you know, for the right time. But I wouldn't call any of these places that are on the market now available to first-time home buyers at all, just from the price alone.
I agree. It's so expensive. So you're struggling because, you know, you get your conventional mortgage with 3%. So but they're still almost better off getting their 3% together, because it's almost like renting an apartment with your first month's insecurity. And this way, at least you do have some kind of foothold. Where you're getting something that's, you know, the rents are not going to keep. It won't be out of your control. You'll know what you're dealing with. And then you can build some type of future and stability.
John, did you guys just get re-taxed?
Oh, yeah. The bill was just about what I expected it to be. You know, it's about a 35 to 40% increase.
I have 100.
Oh, my God.
I was telling you that yesterday. John Lee. That's what he told me about his place in Edgebrook. But wow. Do you think there's any connection between... Is it the taxes that are causing the for sale signs, or the fact that you walk down the block?
I think it's, you know, it's probably both. I think the places are becoming too, for whatever alternatives any of these owners have. Some of them, you know, I'm surprised to see that they're on the market, because I thought some of these places just, you know, were bought by people within the last 3 or 4 years. So it isn't like they're really flipping them. It's not as quick as you would call a flip, but I have a hunch that the reality has settled in, that these houses have far more carrying charges than people.
Between the water bill and the tax bill and everything else, how can you afford to? I mean, how do you?
Right, and the insurance, you know, and just the hassle. I mean,
They're just literally going to drive people out of Illinois. And I still see no evidence of life getting dramatically better for anybody or improvements. I would love to know where all this money's going. We can't get a balanced budget out of Illinois. I would love to. You know what? Wait, you know what Illinois needs? Doge to come in and clean house there. I would love that.
Well, something's wrong.
Let's go see
something
what's
really
going on in Illinois.
Something's really wrong with the economy. I was in the, there I was hanging around the Home Depot on Saturday. And this is 2 weeks in a row.
Looking for a job?
You know what? They had more employees than they had people. I had five people dying to help me. I'm like, the best was, so I get this guy, and he says, hey, can I help you? You know, I had a couple things on the cart. And I said, well, I'm just looking for some plasterboard screws. I think they're probably, well, I'll get them for you. Go on over there. And he gets me the plasterboard screws, which I could have done myself. And he goes, well, now what do you need? I need a couple of plasterboard for the screws. I'll go with you. It's an older guy. He helps me put the two pieces of plasterboard on the thing. I'm walking by the pro thing. Hey, you can check out right here. So then the door's not open. So I start heading down the other way. And this very nice black lady says to me, where are you going? And I said, well, I'm heading for the exit. Well, where are you parked? I mean, right here, I'll open up the big door for you. All of a sudden, this huge, I finally.
Just think how much better their business would be if they acted like that all.
But I mean, there's nobody there. I mean,
did you get your customer survey from Home Depot about that?
Oh, yet? I get them online all the time. But
because they'll ask you. Will you have to give them personally by somebody.
Well,
they get the same response. Yeah.
They get more greeters there than they do at Walmart. And right. you know what's there? They're I tell you what, and this is, you know, no point in a political discussion, but usually outside there's, you know, 8 to 10 Hispanic guys. They're not there. And inside, a lot of the people doing the buying are Hispanic people that are doing remodeling for people. Didn't see one of those. I'm going to say that they had more employees. This is Saturday at noon. Like, it's got to be like they're almost their biggest time in that area. They were easily outnumbered, employees outnumbered customers. It's 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah. The last couple of times I've been at my Home Depot at Kimball and Addison, I don't see contractors in there.
No.
I see, you know, individuals, families. You know, it's a very different kind of traffic pattern from what I've saw.
Well, you know what, part of that too is, yeah, part of, I think, I know you're right about that time, but part of it, it's also getting to be seasonal. The holidays are coming up.
Yeah.
And most people are done remodeling until February or March. So, but it's a good idea. It's a good time, December, January, to get some remodeling business probably done a little cheaper before spring craziness.
Well, you just did some remodeling, so you're up on the prices. And Jen's kind of hanging around at Home Depot, so you know some about this. You're talking about the Ray's Ranch / Bungalow. And these are the kind of homes that Jen and Rod's talking about her. These are your basic Chicago, you know, living room, dining room, kitchen, three bedrooms, one and a half bath. Some are, you know, 20 feet wide, some are 30 feet wide, so there's difference in sizes, basically with a full basement. You know, your basic Chicago home. If you were to, somebody handed you the lot, what do you suppose it would cost you to put one of those up? I'm saying it's pushing 2.25, bud. I don't think you could, this whole idea that, you know, coming from administrations, Republican and Democrat, we're going to build new homes to cut the prices down. I think the cost of new homes are more expensive than what they're going for.
Well, you're never going to go way far back, because that typical three-bedroom Ray's Ranch that one of my uncles bought, and people thought he was crazy because it was so far out, west of Midway Airport, like 57th and... Monitor, something like that, in the M's in Chicago, Streets. We all know where that is.
Stop for a second. In Chicago, you've got the K's are like between this
Pulaski
mile west.
Pulaski.
Yeah, then there's the
L's.
M, the L's.
The
and then there's the M. So you can tell which street is, how far west you are in Chicago.
Yeah.
It goes from Pulaski to Harlem. It starts for some reason at the K's. I never figured that out. And then ends up at the O's.
Yeah, the O's way west. That's a Chicago
O's
thing. So when Art says it's in the M's, we all know what she's talking about. I don't know if anybody else does.
It's part of our grid system.
Yes.
Yes.
But go ahead, Ann. You were talking. You were saying.
I forgot what I was saying now.
You're talking about you're doing a house out there in the M's.
Oh, so he bought a house and my parents were talking about how this wildly crazy house he bought at the time, and he paid $21,000 for it. And my aunt and uncle moved from 50th and Sealy out to Midway Airport, which was a huge leap.
At
that time, y'all lived close to your relatives in the same neighborhood. And that area was just being built with hundreds and hundreds of those, which are still standing because they were built beautifully. But to your point, that $21,000 house now is probably worth between at least $350,000.
But I'll bet it would cost $200 to put it up.
Yeah. I would say it would easily cost $200 to put it up.
All right, give us a shameless plug. How do people find you?
Anytime you can, you send me a text or an email. My text is 708-846-6494, or give me a call. Be happy to help you buying or selling your real estate.
I can give John a shameless plug, but he doesn't want anybody to find him.
I'm trying to remove my online profile.
We do get all tides. Well, if you get a chance, pile in and listen to Di earlier, because she's terrific as usual.
I will.
And by the way, there's a big. When was that? It's the Army Navy game. They're having a big
December 13th.
Yeah, they're having a fundraiser out in Rosemont. Not Rosemont, Roselle.
Roselle, VFW, I think.
Yeah, we should. We'll talk about that. It sounds like fun.
Everybody, go be fun.
Yeah, Army Navy games. I mean, I would one of these years.
I don't care about the football. Go for the food and the booze. Right.
I would like to go to an Army Navy game some year.
I bet there's a lot of cute guys there.
Yeah, but they all wear those big, huge overcoats. How do you know? You just assume they are. Those guys have to pay. They have to pay for that stuff themselves, don't they? You don't get those gorgeous over.
I think you pay. I think you do.
Yeah. Anyway, SP Futures down 12. NASDAQ Futures down 41. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Jimmy. Nice job, Matt. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. Dax Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
Louie, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.